Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good evening and welcome, Gaias and fans of Voices of the Sacred Feminine. Thank you for tuning in as we wind down our Foremothers and Wayshowers series. Though, as I've said before, while some of our guest names might be more familiar to some of you than others, it's really hard not to call each of our guests a Wayshower or a Foremother. And I hope you can stay with us for the entire show. At the top of the hour, we have our second international guest this month calling in. He's Michael York, calling in from Amsterdam, where it is 3 a.m. in the morning, so we really appreciate him staying awake to talk to us. And we're going to discuss a favorite topic of mine, because I have what I like to refer to at home as a goddess husband, who I've been married to for 25 years. And the topic that Michael and I are going to discuss is men who love goddess. And also, you might recognize Michael's name because he gave a paper at the Parliament of World Religions on that very topic. Then at the bottom of the hour is our What's the Buzz segment, where I discuss the bees buzzing around in my bonnet related to goddess spirituality, whether we're talking about the great she in terms of deity archetype or ideal or the feminine consciousness or right brain thinking or feminism, and new news of things going on all around the world. So listen to that and our new announcements at the close of the show. And did you know March is Women's History Month? Let's make this a time to really reclaim the contributions women have made to society, going back to the earliest of times in ancient civilizations up to contemporary times today. You know, knowledge is power, and there are those who would rather what we talk about, what we study, what we share would remain hidden and swept beneath the rug. Hey, but that's not my nature. If you tell me that door has to stay closed, that's just incentive for me to try twice as hard to pry it open. And if you don't mind, if I digress a moment, that reminds me of when my husband Roy and I were in the Naples Museum. The museum was holding hostage the artifacts from the Temple of Isis from the archaeological site in Pompeii. You see, only wealthy benefactors were allowed to see the artifacts if they gave the museum hefty donations. Well, I'd come halfway around the world, I'd saved my pennies for years and years to see those artifacts, and there was only a bulletin board blocking an open doorway that stood between me and those artifacts. So, what did I do? Well, I'm not proud of it, or I don't know, maybe I am. I sent Roy on a mission to create a distraction so the museum guard's attention would be focused elsewhere, and I slipped in among all those precious artifacts, and I snapped very quickly two rolls of film, then emerged from the room feeling like I was 007 or something, and I just completed my assignment. But anyway, just a reminder to keep you motivated. You know, there is a movement afoot, yes. Have no doubt, make no mistake, yes, even the Dalai Lama recognizes that Western women and like-minded men are being called upon to save the world, and he has even said so publicly. You and your kindred are being asked to step up like so many foremothers and wayshowers have been called at crucial times at the crossroads of herstory. So utilize that energy of Sekhmet, Kali Ma, Lady Libertas, Bridget, Durga, the Morrigan. Let their fire burn within you to transform yourself and your world. Find within you your spiritual warrior and lend your vital energy toward the shift that's coming to rebirth the great she into our world. And remember, you're not alone. Whether you're sitting in your little studio apartment in Sacramento or Topeka, Kansas, whether you're sitting on a balcony in Oxford or your house is in Istanbul, this effort is happening far beyond the space we each occupy. You are part of a movement. You are awakening the world to a planetary shift of profound proportion for people everywhere just by being who you are, thinking what you think, sharing what you know, and speaking your voice. And the momentum is building. Awareness is raising. Social justice is on the lips of people across Mother Earth as they're filled with this tenacity to save our world. Sometimes it may not look like it, but that's how a paradigm shift manifests. Slowly, slowly at first, building momentum, raising awareness, raising consciousness, it starts to form a wave, it swirls, it churns, it ebbs, it flows, it's happening. I have no doubt. You may be that 100th monkey. Your energy might be the one to tip that morphic field and birth that paradigm shift to create the meaningful change. Being here tonight is just one of those steps. Now make your commitment to take the next step. You or her voice, let the world see and hear you loud and clear. And as always, thanks goes out to the wonderful artists who so generously allow me to use their music. So here's a plug for Jenna Green. And the snippet of a song you heard at our opening is called Acceptance. And we have some new artists coming on board in the coming weeks, so I'm sure you'll enjoy just as much as our current artists. Well, it's almost time to get to our guest tonight, Michael York, who I'm going to tell you more about in just a minute. But first, one last thing. I want you to know what I have in store for you during my What's the Buzz segment at the bottom of the hour. And I invite you to call in and talk to me. Or if you're like many of my listeners who actually listen from the archives, then send me emails and I'll read those on the air. And tonight, the What's the Buzz segment is going to cover some of these things. I want to share with you a cartoon from God. Very interesting. Also, in keeping with Women's History Month, I want you to know about the powerful visionary and chief of the Cherokee Nation. Her name is Wilma Mankiller. And that's not because she doesn't like men. It's a surname for her tribe. Then we're going to get into the fact that 15 years ago, Hillary declared women's rights to be human rights. And we'll discuss how far we've come since then. I'd like to touch on what's happening quickly with the women in Haiti and something interesting from Ms. Magazine called The Mystery of Women's History. And we've talked about it before, but there's new stuff that you might want to hear along the lines of sexual assaults on female soldiers in the military. And then we're going to close out another week of What's the Buzz, and our final topic will be male prostitution scandal that's currently rocking the Vatican. Wonder if you've heard about it, because it's not on the evening news. So please stay tuned in after I interview tonight's guest for our What's the Buzz segment. Then I'll close out the evening with announcements of events near and far before we share our closing prayer from the Dalai Lama. And remember, listeners, you can call in and talk to my guest or myself. The call-in number is 718-766-4662. But without further delay, let me turn my attention to this week's guest who's patiently waiting, Wayshower Michael York, who I believe is currently in Amsterdam. And I want to tell you a bit about him. I love the bio he's written about himself, not your typical dry credentials for sure. Michael says, he was born breech birth, feet first, mother 48 hours in labor, born in the psychic catchment of Niagara Falls, Buffalo, into a strong matriarchal line that taught him an appreciation of elves, goblins, leprechauns, and fairies. He attended Purdue University, NYU, UCLA, UC Berkeley, received his BA in English from the University of California in Santa Barbara, an MA in International Relations from San Francisco State U, and a PhD in theology from King's College, London. He became a professor of cultural astronomy and astrology at Bath Spa University, England. He has lived in lots of places, Maplewood, New Jersey, West Lafayette, Indiana, Goleta, Los Angeles, Berkeley, San Francisco, Amsterdam, the Netherlands, France, Ireland, London, other places in the United Kingdom, even Varanasi, India. He's traveled probably more than me. He's been through Mexico, Scandinavia, the Low Countries, Germany, France, Great Britain, Ireland, Italy, Spain, Portugal, Greece, Yugoslavia, Switzerland, the list goes on and on, including Africa and the Middle East and Asia. And he says he's not finished yet. His doctoral dissertation was published as The Emerging Network, A Sociology of the New Age and Neo-Pagan Movements in 1995. The same year saw the publication of his magnum opus, The Divine versus the Asurian, an interpretational of Indo-European cult and myth. And then two other works of his are The Roman Festival Calendar of Numa Pompilius and Pagan Theology, Paganism as a World Religion. Wow. Michael, you've been busy, and of course you've just been at the Parliament of World Religions. How do you find the time?
How do I find the time? I wish I knew. I don't think I have an answer for that question.
Well, or you might be 200 years old, and I just don't know it.
I sometimes feel that way. At least I'm a Virgo by birth, so Virgos are supposed to be organized, and maybe that's partly what helps me be able to do what I do.
Well, you know, you and I shared that blessing and curse. That's certainly a double-edged sword, being a Virgo, isn't
it? Yes, it is.
I'm held captive constantly by the constant lists I make, and no sooner I scratch something off the list, I add something on, so I'm never finished that list.
Exactly.
Well, Michael, tell us about what it was like at the Parliament of World Religions. And, you know, we've had Patrick McCullum on the show. He talked a bit about it. But from your perspective, tell us what that was like, and tell us about the paper you gave and how it was received. You know, just sort of bring us up to date. You know, let us live vicariously through you.
All right. Well, the Parliament in Melbourne was the fourth Parliament of the World's Religions that I've attended, first being Chicago and then Barcelona and then Cape Town and then Barcelona and now the one in Melbourne. And they've each been different, especially for what I would call the pagan community, which I have always attended in connection with. The one in Chicago was really celebratory for the pagans, because it was the first time that we were recognized by a world body or by something official. And so it was quite celebratory. I don't think we were necessarily at our level-headed best, but it was understandable under the circumstances. In Cape Town, I think that's where we really pulled ourselves together, really organized, and connected on the interfaith level, probably the best that we did it at any of these parliaments. Barcelona, we were more focused on ourselves, and in a way that was true with all the different religions. They basically seemed to focus on themselves and interact with their own, and we were no different in that sense. I mean, that's not to say that we didn't also engage in interfaith, but I think our real interfaith efforts were the strongest in Cape Town. The Parliament in Melbourne, for me, was really a balance between the two. We had a very, very strong interfaith presence and interaction, but we also had a very strong intra-pagan interaction. Each Parliament, they're always overwhelming. Just the interconnection with so many different people representing so many different viewpoints. There is nothing else that I've ever experienced quite like it. So
well,
they're
Michael,
really
just for some context, how many people actually attend these parliaments?
Well, because of the economic downturn and the fact that it was in Australia, this one was probably not attended by as many as the others. I think it was around 5,000 on this occasion. The initial one in Chicago, I think, was closer to 8,000. So there was a slight drop, but you really would not have noticed it or felt it because it was really quite full. And there's always so much happening that you can only just scratch a bare surface of it.
So from your perspective, how were the pagans received? Were they... I have this impression sometimes that, let me say this. Lady Olivia Robertson told me once about at a past parliament, they were actually worried for her life, that she would be assassinated by possibly, a Christian zealot. Did you meet with any sort of resistance from the Christians or any other group?
If there's a reaction to the pagans, it's one of, they see us as something ridiculous. They don't take us seriously. I don't really think that we threaten anybody, at least anybody who is open enough to come to an interfaith event or parliament. On other occasions, not on this one, but on other occasions, you would have people boycott parliament. In Chicago, for instance, we had right-wing fundamentalists condemning the satanic proceedings going on inside the Palmer House Hilton. And again, in Cape Town, there were Muslim demonstrations against the parliament, basically condemning in the same way that the Christian fundamentalists had in Chicago. But in Melbourne, we didn't have that. There are some people who are uneasy about us. First of all, we're not taken particularly seriously, but I don't think anybody sees us really as a threat. At least I never came across that.
Well, did you find that there was a lot of misunderstanding about who pagans really are? I mean, was the pervasive cliche alive that, you know, it's about Satan and, you know, just, you know, pointed hats and sacrificing babies? I mean, that's silly stuff.
I haven't encountered that. What I do remember is a number of people coming to our sessions and finding them quite enlightening and were quite impressed and declared openly that they had different understandings, not that they saw what those understandings were, but were much more impressed with efforts and our seriousness. And that was what I encountered the most in Melbourne.
They have a sense that, you guys aren't so strange and weird after all. We can kind of
exactly
see where you're coming from.
Exactly, exactly.
Well, you know, I'm sorry.
Well, just that do seem to be building bridges, and we make contact with a lot of other people and interfaith networks and organizations, and that seems to be favorable. There was a lot of criticism of the parliament. I was one of the people who voiced it, that I felt that the parliament needed to start taking positions on the global arena on particular issues. And the parliament itself is organized in a sense to do that, that what they want to do, what if the people who are attending, when they then return home, to then carry the policies or the principles of the parliament, especially in terms of interfaith. So there's a kind of a, when I made that declaration in Hans Kung session, I was really quite surprised how many people applauded, because they do want to see the parliament gain on more of an actual active official engaging role. But as it is set up at this point, it's more to motivate us and for us then to individually carry out our work after the parliament.
Well, I guess, you know, baby steps are better than no steps, right?
Exactly. Yes.
Well, and the idea of the interfaith, it's so logical. I mean, I know just myself growing up in New Orleans, it was the Bible Belt. I was born into a Catholic family. I went, you know, probably 2 decades of my life not meeting anyone who wasn't like me. And I really have to remind myself, you know, now that I don't live like that anymore, how many people still do? You know, they never meet a gay person. They never meet somebody from another religion. So it's so easy then for these fear-mongering, you know, types who want to just, you know, have control to then, you know, really sort of manipulate these people who, you know, have never met a pagan, you know, have never met maybe a gay person or somebody from another country. I'm just really appalled at, you know, the level of awareness of so many Americans here in the United States. And I have to constantly keep reminding myself, you know, that education. And I just wish there was more of a push for this, you know, interfaith dialogue or, we just need to know about the rest of our human family. It seems so simple, but yet so hard to accomplish.
I agree totally on that. And sometimes it's enormously depressing, and just by the dauntingness of the whole task. On the other hand, I believe, as you just said it, education, that is the root. And I think, and we're making inroads. It's not that we're moving backwards. We may not be moving as fast as we wish, but, and sometimes it's only incremental, but even the incremental movement forward is a progressive step. And we have to be happy with that and then work on top of that.
No, I agree. You know, I'm one of these impatient people that wants it all to happen, much more quickly than it realistically, can maybe happen. And I guess, you know, it sort of pushes my buttons because these days I'm really frustrated with, progressives, no matter what religion they are, why they aren't coming out and speaking about what's happening out in the world. You know, they should be using their bully pulpit to, set a tone for the things that should be important in the world. And it just seems like, the only voices from any sort of religion you hear, or people saying, well, let's pray for Obama and the liberals on the Supreme Court to die. Let's blame the people in Haiti and the people in New Orleans. It was their sin that caused these disasters, or they're against Prop 8, or, it's all of this divisiveness rather than positive things to uplift us and, help society move forward.
There is this terrible insular quality that we find. I just was communicating with someone who's mother had died, and he had to go back with his lover to Texas for the funeral. And the Catholic relatives attended the funeral, but the Protestants would not attend because they're afraid that they would catch homosexuality through contagion with the two of them. So there's that type of thinking. I really don't know how to understand it, except that I've come to the conclusion that half of our world, basically through the Abrahamic religions, and I wouldn't say this for all people who follow the Abrahamic religions, but there is something almost inherent in its concept of deity or Godhead, which is divisive. And I really feel that these people have been hexed in some cultural sense. And our task is somehow to find ways of de-hexing them, whether through education, through magic, I'm not sure which, and maybe a little bit of everything.
Right.
But we have to open people's imagination, and that's our real challenge. Go ahead.
Well, I think besides opening their imaginations, I think all of this is based on fear. And maybe that goes back again to, maybe you have to rub shoulders with a gay person or a black person or somebody from Europe or, somebody who's not like you. And then you start to realize that, people everywhere are really the same. I really started picking up that idea when we would travel. Most of the people I grew up with lived and died within a 50-mile radius of their hometown. But, I had this gypsy spirit, and I wanted to get out there and see the world. And, it's like, once you start to see the rest of the people out there, you really have more of a concept of a global human family. You educate yourself on history, and that homosexuality was just a common thing, and the Greeks didn't even have a word for it. And, mm-hmm. It's just Oh, I don't know. I'm sorry. I'll get off my soapbox. But it's just the anti-intellectualism makes me crazy.
There's something profoundly sad about it. And we cannot be intimidated by that. We have to just still move forward. And you see breakthroughs all the time. Maybe not. We see things changing, and we just have to be optimistic and go for that positive thing. And eventually, if enough of us are doing it, and we're all being Johnny Appleseeds and throwing the seeds as far as we can, and eventually some of those seeds are going to take root and produce more seeds. And
right.
I believe in that process, and I'm a militant optimist when it really comes down to it. So,
I think that's good advice. Well, so just we'll get off the subject in just one brief minute, but tell me, is it different in Europe? I mean, I have this idea that they're much more secular, they're much more advanced, maybe better educated. Is it really different over there?
Vastly different, yes. Europe has become a real secular bastion. You do have a growth of paganism, and I think secularism has served pagans enormously in that it's provided a divide and a freedom or emancipation from Abrahamic intimidations. And the shortcoming of secularism is its mechanical view of the cosmos. And I think it opens the ground for those of us who don't want to go the route of old time religion to rediscover enchantment. And that to me is what paganism essentially is about. Finding enchantment, working with nature, and harnessing the two for the well-being of the planet and all life on the planet.
Michael, then let's shift gears a little bit here, because I do want to talk about the paper that you gave at the Parliament, and it's of particular interest to me because I grew up learning about Goddess through a Dianic community. And I always had one foot in the Dianic community, and I thank those women for teaching me about Goddess, but it never totally felt right to me. It felt out of balance personally, because I knew too many men who loved Goddess, who believed what we believed, and I didn't want to, just have a spirituality that was limited to, to just women. So your paper, Men Who Love the Goddess, that really jumped out at me. And I guess I just wanted to hear what you had to say and how it was received and what inspired it.
All right. I was invited to be part of that panel through Drake Spaeth, who had organized Men Who Love the Goddess. We were basically pretty free to approach it and handle it as we wished. And so I was attending the Parliament basically as a polytheist. That was what my own paper was about, the multiple understanding of deity. And so my position in the panel, and again, I didn't have a paper. We were all talking fairly open and spontaneously. As a polytheist, my initial question is, when you talk about the goddess, then I would say, which goddess? And part of my feeling, it goes back, I first heard this from Melissa Raphael, but Wendy Griffin informed me that Melissa actually got it from Charlene Spretnik. And that was the idea of, if we really a goddess, the goddess, there's the danger of putting, what we're doing is putting Yahweh into a skirt. And that's my real unease with monotheism of any form, whether it's masculine or feminine, I really uphold and try to champion the plurality of hobby. And of course, that plurality includes masculine and feminine. It includes the many. It can become the one, but the one will immediately become two, and the two will become three, and so forth. And I think that fluidity of deity is the thing that I want to essentially concentrate on. And so that was part of what I brought into my talk. If we were to look at paganism as a distinct religious type, and in my own understanding, there's basically four religious orientations. The Abrahamic, which believes in a transcendental personal God separate from the manifest reality. You have your Dharmic, which religions, Hinduism and Buddhism, which basically denies the reality of matter. Maybe Theravada Buddhism doesn't deny matter, but it doesn't see it as having any value. So it's matter is meaningless. And the Dharmic religions have a kind of an impersonal understanding of God, or even no God.
So they they don't really have a close connection with nature then.
Not in the same. No, I don't think they do. Again, I'm really talking as a sociologist right now. I'm talking in terms of ideal types, and when I'm talking about Abrahamic and Dharmic and secular in this sense, I'm talking about the ideal. Any particular actual religion or practice would be a blend of any of these ideal types. And so I think you do find, I do know Hindus that are very concerned with the environment.
Okay.
And I know Christians as well, many of them. So, but the basic orientation in both the Abrahamic and the Dharmic religions is otherworldly, is to devalue or to escape this world. The secularists don't get into that at all. They uphold this world. They cherish this world. They love the world. And I think in that sense, the pagans do as well. But the pagans find divinity in and from matter. They don't see the spiritual as something purely transcendental and other. Matter is the mother. The spiritual is born from matter. And the physical is as sacred as anything else could be or might be. And I think that's the real distinction between the pagan position and your other three, your Dharmic, Abrahamic, and secular, is that we see the physical as sacred in and of itself. And we see us as the children. Literally, we're humans, meaning we're earthlings. From humus or earth, we are the children of the earth. And that physicality and the sacredness of the material, tangible, is what distinguishes us from other religious positions. So that being said, I would argue that if there is a one goddess, and I'm hesitant to put it in those terms, but if there is, it's the earth. It's our earth mother. It's matter. And we all are born from matter, and matter has an intrinsic desire to become conscious. And we are simply vehicles in that process of matter becoming conscious. But it's not a refutation of the physical. It's a cherishing and a celebration of the physical, along with whatever else emerges and develops from the physical.
So was this not to digress from this idea of goddess, but I wanted to ask you about this panel, Men Who Love the Goddess. Was there even the conception of such a panel because of what I alluded to, before we started talking about that, because there is this sense sometimes within goddess spirituality that it's primarily a religion for women?
I don't think any of us on the panel felt that.
Okay.
I don't know how many men, but myself and the people that I know are as passionately devoted to the feminine, to goddess or goddesses, as I would prefer, and don't think of it in terms of something that is for women and not for humanity.
Okay. Well, and I totally agree with you, you know, but having come from that, you know, lived amongst that sort of, you know, that Dianic outlook, you know, and the reaction of men in Los Angeles to that Dianic outlook, I was just curious if, you know, that sort of, you know, idea was the inspiration, you know, for the panel, you know, men who love goddess. Okay.
We'd have to ask Drake on that because he was the one that organized it, and I didn't get that impression from him or from any of the others. And I think basically, pagan men at least recognize the role and place and need for the Dianic emphasis. I've known many, many women. And I guess you would be included in that, who began with the Dianic traditions.
Mm-hmm.
And all seem to still honor it, but many of them move on to something more open, more all-embracing,
right,
and not as divisive. But I think as men, I think most pagan men at least, recognize that place and that women should have their own space. Everyone should have their own space.
Well, and likewise for men, obviously.
Yeah. Right, right.
Well, and when you said, when you talked about seeing goddess as, you know, the goddess, if we get monotheistic about it, it's like Yahweh in a skirt. It really sort of reminds me of the feminist term that we use, patriarchy in a skirt. You know, because so many people, when we talk about the goddess, they think, well, you know, we just want to shift things around so that women are in charge and, you know, we want to oppress or suppress men and we have a female deity. And, well, of course, that's not what any of us are about either. I mean, that's a, you know, that's a misconception in itself.
Right. Well, I mean, that probably some of that does exist, but I don't think that's the dominant end. If it was dominant at one point, it no longer is. And, go ahead.
I was gonna go to the next idea. So you don't believe the idea that you know there's how would you call it, one divine source that is the great she. You really do prefer to look at it polytheistically, where there are many goddesses, many cultures, different aspects. And am I understanding your outlook properly?
Partly. I don't think there is a transcendental divine source. I think there is a physical, immanent divine source. And to me, that's matter and energy, because energy is simply a different form of matter. And to me, that is where one finds divinity, and that is where we all take our root. And as matter has that intrinsic desire to become conscious, and we are part of that process, we reach for a different, more abstract realm. But that realm is only valid to the degree that we still remain rooted to our maternal connection, and that is to matter.
Mm-hmm.
So okay. I would not reify the feminine in some sort of abstract or transcendental sense. I see her as physical, tangible, touchable, imminent, grounded.
And so where does God fit into the picture? Do you see... you know, define God then.
Oh, dear. God to me seems to be a huge mistake. I think it develops from some kind of a volcanic desert entity called Yahweh, who became totally hubristic and said, "I'm the only one." And initially, apparently, all the gods laughed when they first heard that. But he is a powerful one. And, you know, I don't think we can deny the fact that there are negative powers, whether it's just in our own mind or not. This type of thing exists, and it has to be combated. And I think it basically has to be combated through education.
Well, let's stay on the topic of God for just a second, and then I want to talk to you about how you believe some goddesses are divine and some some are not. If you're a polytheist, then put Yahweh aside. Is there a place in your spiritual paradigm for the pagan gods? You know, Osiris. Tammuz. Attis. From the pagan traditions.
Oh, well, yeah, without a doubt. I basically work within a European or Indo-European framework. And so the deities that I'm most comfortable with or most familiar with are Roman, Greek, Vedic, and the Nordic and Celtic figures. But I'm such a polytheist, and I enjoy gods in any setting. And so when we were in Bali, I spent most of my time going to Balinese Hindu temples. In Australia, I went to Uluru and communed with that sacred site. So I do like and love deities, gods and goddesses, but I also love and revere sacred places, and they don't have to be a particular deity. It can be the sacred that's imminent in a particular location. I'm really I don't know what the word would be, almost a prostitute as far as worshiping different gods and goddesses.
No. I was just about to say that I think I'm realizing, and a concept I don't think I've actually languaged before, but understood on probably an unconscious level, is that when you're a polytheist, that's almost like an antidote or becoming a fundamentalist. If you're a polytheist, you have this open-minded idea about God, and then you don't get into this crazy place that, makes you, blow up buildings or something because other people, see the divine in another face.
I hope so. I mean, there could be instances where, especially when you get into the ethnic identity of your gods and goddesses, and that does exist, and so people are into their own gods and goddesses and not somebody else's. But when you go back into the past, especially the Roman Empire, they were always saw the other gods in terms of their own gods and drew parallels and connections and identities between them. And that was an open, ongoing, pluralistic process. It was never fixed and permanent, because at one point one god of one people should be identified with a particular god and another, but then it could be identified with another god of those same people. So it was never anything rigorously done. It was always done semi-intuitively and certainly openly. And I think when you relax with a deity and you work with that deity, you begin to understand the nuances and the interconnections that deity will have with other deities. They all reduce to one, but because that one is not a fixed one, it becomes multiple as soon as it ever becomes one. So it's an ongoing, open, moving situation.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, and as you're saying that, I'm thinking about, you know, all the museums we've been in Europe, and one of these statues comes to mind. It was the statue of Isis Aphrodite, you know, and this idea that different deities could exist in the same temple and their statues would actually represent the embodiment of both deities from different cultures. I don't know, it just seems so much healthier than what we have going on today.
Well, I mean, in the fundamentalist circle, the cosmopolitanism is a dirty word, and yet I think it's one of the most beautiful. And that idea of equating deities began under Alexander the Great and the Hellenistic empires or kingdoms, and then the Romans took that over, and that was a wonderful kind of each had his own, but each understood the connections of his own with the other. And I think that's something that I would hate to see ultimately surrendered and lost in our world. And we have to emancipate the fundamentalist. I'm not quite sure how we do that yet, but that's...
Well, and I think in a way that's the beauty of paganism. You know, we don't really have any problem sort of appropriating another culture's deity for one thing. I mean, like myself, for instance, I was attracted to Isis, and I'm certainly not, you know, from that part of the world. And I don't know, it just seems like, well, you know, maybe it's because I haven't met too many fundamentalist pagans, but, it, you know, so much more open-minded. You know, it's like goddess becomes the poster girl for diversity and tolerance, in a sense, because you see her many faces, you know, across continents and cultures. And I don't know, at least that's the way I think of it. You know, it feels like if people could stand under the umbrella of goddess spirituality, they wouldn't have... Well, I mean, I'm sure they'll always find something to argue about, but they wouldn't kill each other over it.
I would hope. I mean, but you did mention that word appropriate, and I think we have to be careful on that score, because at the first parliament, I got very involved with the Native American community, and they had two really peak... first of all, they did the opening invocation of the parliament. They invoked the four directions, and that was enormously moving, and I think it really set the tenor for the whole proceedings and everything ever since. And then there was another point. It was a session called Voices of the Dispossessed, and they would have people from a minority position come up and lay out their complaints, and the organizers of the parliament had never foreseen this possibility, but it ultimately erupted to a huge pandemonium between the Hindus and the Sikhs when a Sikh was explaining that about all the massacre of the Sikhs in Delhi. Of course, very conveniently overlooking the fact that this Prime Minister Indira Gandhi had just been assassinated. And the Hindus, who are basically enormously tolerant people, just blew up at this. And the parliament was actually finished at that moment. I remember seeing the organizers with their mouths wide open, standing on the stage and their hands just dangling by their sides, and they hadn't foreseen this at all. And some people started singing the Martin Luther King refrain, "We Shall Overcome." And the Native Americans were the next scheduled speakers, and they came out and they said, "We're not going to give our talk. We've decided instead to have a healing dance. And we invite anyone who wants to participate to please do so." And at the end of it, it culminated, and they said, "Please embrace whoever is closest to you." And they literally, literally saved the parliament. But
wow.
That being said, and this is what makes it all so fascinating, in their own suite, which I attended along, Selena Fox and I basically visited them every evening, what they were discussing was their declaration of war, and they were still upset that they had not been invited to the first parliament in 1893. They were upset by seeing their medicine bags in the Field Museum on display and opened. They came back in tears, and So their grievances are all legitimate, but they were working on this declaration of war. And one of the clauses in that was against New Age and, the way they phrased it, neo-paganist appropriation. Their argument is that we have the tendency, we Euro-American, to appropriate their own cultural items, their institutions, and they feel endangered by that because that's the last thread of their identity. And if we take these things, they lose. So that's why I'm just saying, at one point I thought, well, do we really, all religions have appropriated from one another, and that's the nature of religion. But in our day and age, we have to do that very sensitively and really understand what the implications are. ISIS doesn't belong to any existing people in that sense now. And so ISIS is fair and open to appropriate. I don't even really like the word appropriate, but I think you work with deities. And I think we can work with many different deities, but we have to be careful with some of them. If we, even in our own pagan traditions, if we look at Santeria, Candomblé, Lukumi, they're very defensive about people using their orishas or their deities without having gone through proper initiations. And they claim that it's dangerous, that we don't know what we're dealing with, and we could be unleashing great havoc and harm in that process. So it's something that we have to be mindful of. And so appropriation is it's a difficult word.
No, I understand. No, and that's a good point, and I appreciate you making that. You know, I was aware of the Native American concerns. It's come up. You know, I mean, I know women who have tried to sort of become, you know, part of that, and, you know, they've met with resistance because, the Native Americans feel like we are trying to appropriate something of theirs, and I can understand. They have, you know, they have been so misused and in everything they went through in this country, and I mean that's just part of it. So we really do have to be careful not to to step on their toes and disrespect or appropriate their spirituality and turn it into something that it isn't.
Exactly. All right, I'll just bring the end of that little story. Of the parliament in Chicago, Selena was very upset about the neo-paganist clause, and I had to argue with her. I said, if this is important to them that they have it in there, then let's not fight them on that. Let them have it. And I went by the last evening of the whole parliament. And I thought, all right, it's going to be a fait accompli. Let's see where it is now. And they saw me at the door and they said, oh, come quick, and they thrust this piece of paper in my hands, and it was called a Declaration of Vision. And the New Age Neo-Paganist clause had been dropped because they wanted everything on one page and it didn't fit. So that was one thing. But I was amazed. I said, how did you get from this Declaration of War to this Declaration of Vision? And I didn't realize it, but basically the elders had been just sitting around in the background listening to all the debating. And they finally said, all right, we want to discuss this now, and we want the rest of you to leave. And they sent all the younger, argumentative, militant people out, redrafted the declaration, signed it, and when they came back, it was a fait accompli. You do not question the elder. So that's how that was resolved on that instance.
Well, Michael, we don't have too much longer. We have about 10 minutes left. And I wanted to ask you about this idea, and I wanted you to explain it to me, that not all goddesses are divine, but the goddesses that you love are divine. What's the distinction between the divine and the anti-divine?
Okay. The anti-divine does not really exist. It does operate. So I would say that Yahweh is an instance of the anti-divine. It doesn't have empirical reality. It doesn't have reality, but it does have an operative force. That's why I talk about Abrahamic people being hexed, because it's a mind game. Now, the traditional ways of in the European tradition or the Indo-European tradition of using metaphors for the anti-divine, the volcano was one, the tempest was another, the drought was a third. And different deities, or not, I wouldn't call them deities, but the deities are divine, but different gods and goddesses were the symbols of both nature and divinity, but also some were metaphors or symbols for the anti-divine. And you can, it's a laborious process, but you can trace it all basically historically and through comparative mythologies and so forth. And there are some goddesses which I think are more emblematic of the anti-divine than the fertility, loving, nature-oriented mother goddesses and her daughters.
Could you give some examples?
I would say Astarte is a prime example of the anti-divine. Tiamat is also, and so I know in feminist circles today, there's this wish to reappropriate the dragon. And some dragons are positive. Some dragons in China and even in Vedic mythology are givers of rain. But not all dragons are divine. Most dragons are generally used as symbols for the anti-divine. So I would even go so far, and this is where it gets controversial, of identifying Aphrodite as an anti-divine figure. She comes from the Middle East. She, what she basically did was absorb and take over and replace the earlier cult and worship of the dawn goddess, Eos or Ushis or Aurora, whatever her name would have been. And this is more academic, and that's what my magnum opus was about, was tracing those lines of development. And so, go ahead.
Well, when you said your magnum opus, I went and looked at your bio. So to learn more about that, your book, The Divine versus the Asurian, is that still in print? Is it obtainable?
It actually is. It's now being, you can get it through Roman and Littlefield. And they're based in Lanham, Maryland. But I think if you go online, you'll be able to find it.
Well, and it is an interesting concept. I've never heard this before, unless it's been talked about in a different term, and I'm not connecting the dots.
It's not something that's all that widely known. I had in the house that my family moved into in Maplewood, New Jersey, there was a set of Encyclopedia Britannicas. I think it was dated to. I think it was either late 19th century or it was 1911. And in that encyclopedia, I always remember reading this, they talked about how bizarre it was that the term for gods in India, the devas, became the term for the devils in Persia. And the term for the demon in India became the term for the high god, Ahura Mazda, in ancient Persia. And so there was this complete reversal that happened between India and Iran. And they didn't understand why that had happened. They just presented it in this ancient encyclopedia. And that always stayed with me, and I always wanted to understand why and how that happened and what the implications of it were. And that's how I came to this understanding of the Asurian. I actually got that word from a translation of a Rig Vedic hymn in Gordon Wasson's book on Soma. And they referred to the Asurian color at one point. And so I have used that word in opposition to the word divine.
So when you say Asurian, you're meaning anti-divine. And when you say anti-divine, you aren't necessarily meaning a demigod. You're meaning actually a demon?
Not even a demon. I think demons can be divine. The anti-divine, so you have good and evil, and then you have the Asurian in so the thing with the divine works on a polarity. It's many, many opposites. It's male, female. It's light and dark. It's positive and negative. It's matter and spirit. It's all these different polarities, and it's like a cartwheel. They're always all shifting. So there's no one alignment of, for instance, female being dark and negative and so forth. The female can be positive. The female can be light. The male can be negative. The male can be dark. I mean, so you have every kind of combination. But the Asurian, and maybe the best way to understand it would be to go back to the myth of Tiamat. These were the personifications of pre-singularity, to even put it in those terms. And they became unhappy with the noise that gods in life were making, and they wanted to annihilate the whole of existence, the whole of creation, and return to a total sterile nothingness. That's what the Asurian, that's its only impulse, is to undo all of creation, both the positive and the negative.
Ah, okay. So what about Cybele and Artemis? They're from that part of the world. Would they be the anti-divine?
What was the first one? Artemis and who?
Artemis and, I don't, do you say it Cybele or Cybele?
Cybele, or, yes. She's, Cybele, I would say, would be an instance of the anti-mother. Artemis, definitely not.
Okay.
Artemis is a Terra Mater in origin. She becomes a virgin huntress, ultimately, as she develops in classic mythology. She's a bona fide deity.
Okay. Well, Aphrodite did surprise me. I have to admit, you really made my ears perk up.
That always does.
Okay. All right. Well, you know, you've really piqued my curiosity. I want to look for that book. Let me just repeat it again for the listeners, because I can imagine their ears have perked up too. The Divine versus the Asurian, Asurian, An Interpretation of Indo-European Cult and Myth. Sounds very interesting. Well,
right.
Michael, you wanted to mention the idolatry panel for the Contemporary Pagan Studies Group at the AAR. Do you want to talk about that coming up in the fall?
All right. We had an idolatry panel in the at the AAR in Montreal, and it was enormously successful. That was with Graham Harvey, myself, and Bron Taylor. Unfortunately, Graham cannot make the next session. So it looks like it's going to be Bron Taylor, myself, and hopefully Margot Adler, and so it's really the conversation continues. And so, along with polytheism, my great love is idolatry. I love seeing the divine in physical form. Nature worship to me is idolatry. It's become such a negative term in our own Western context, and thanks to basically our biblical heritage, and I think it's unfortunate, and I want to rescue idolatry as witches wanted to rescue witchcraft. There are so many concepts and terms that I think our Judeo-Christian heritage in the West has repressed, and I think unhealthily so.
Right.
And I think a lot of our problems come from that imbalance that particular kind of repressive spirituality has encouraged. And so idolatries, it's just something that it speaks to me. I went to India for over 20 years just to learn how spiritual life was conducted in temples, because we don't have temples really left in the West. We are starting them. But in India, they still exist, and that was my passion, was to learn how does one approach spirituality in an old temple, which would be the closest thing to an ancient pagan temple that we would know. And idolatry is at the heart of Hindu worship.
Right.
And
right.
I think could be and should be also a part of pagan worship.
Well, how lucky you were, actually, have so much time to do that. Certainly that was a gift.
Oh, absolutely. And I thank the goddess for that.
Well, you know what? Forgive me for this, but I'm still stuck on this Asurian thing. And as you were talking about going to India, it made me think about these letters that one of the apostles wrote back to their congregations. And I always forget. I forget who it was. I want to say it was Thomas, but no, it was probably one of the others. I'll have to look it up again.
It
but the
could
point,
be Thomas has associations with India.
Okay, well, maybe it was Thomas. My first thought was probably right. He wrote back to his congregation about actually seeing Kali. And I just love that story, quite frankly. And I guess I'm wondering, where does Kali fit in? Is she one of the divine or anti-divine?
Oh, yeah, absolutely divine. Absolutely
okay.
divine.
So how do you tell the difference? I mean, if you've told me already, I'm sorry, I didn't catch it.
You really find it by their traditions, what they at heart represent. And usually a deity will have some natural phenomena that is at the heart of that deity, like the sun, the moon, the earth, thunder, lightning, so forth. The Asurian figures don't have a natural, they're anti-nature. They're always at heart a concept, whether it's usually it becomes an ethical principle, but it's always an ethical principle that would not be recognized by pagans.
Well, like Lady Libertas, for instance, she's a concept.
She's a concept, but she's a goddess.
there are exceptions.
Yeah, I mean, it's not that deities don't have and produce conceptual personifications as well, but the Asuric figures don't have any natural base. You can always find, I mean, take Fortuna. Fortune is a concept, but Fortuna has a physical origin. She was a... I forget what she was. She's really, I would call her a super, there are super gods and goddesses, which are like Shiva, Vishnu, Fortune, TK in Greek, and there's some other ones there too. They develop later and they become kind of amalgams of other more bona fide deities. But Fortuna was connected with the sun. If you look at their origins and their histories and all their different associations, you usually ultimately can find what it is that particular figure relates fundamentally to.
Okay.
And then you see it basically in how they play out over history and how they're able to be used by people, because deities, part of their whole being is how we actually approach them and use them and redevelop them in a sense. So
okay.
It's an academic thing, but I don't know how to put it more succinctly than that.
It's really interesting. It really is. It's something I want to look into, because I'm wondering what it was about Inanna Ishtar that made her, you know, that she wasn't really connected to nature. And do you remember off the top of your head why she was one of the ones that's the anti-divine?
It's the positions. Wait a moment. Well, I wouldn't include Inanna. I know that Inanna is Sumerian. and Ishtar is Akkadian.
Okay.
And so they are identified, and that often happens. You do have the anti-deity fused at different points with a bona fide deity. And so you have many hybrid instances that can be also discovered. Ishtar, I think it's her military bloodlust nature, and her sexual side is wanton. It's not a gentle sexuality. It's not an ecstatic sexuality. It's more akin to her own bloodlust.
You know what I'm getting a picture of? You remember the Anne Rice movie Queen of the Damned?
Yes. Yes. All right. I'd
anyway,
have to think of further on that, but that could be.
What you're describing is how that character was portrayed, and she was actually, you know, supposedly from the very ancient times. And anyway, that's I wonder if Anne Rice read your book.
I doubt it. I don't think it's been up that long. I mean, again, if you just look at Canaanite mythology, you have the Baal corpus, and then you have the El. The El is considered the father god, the supreme god. He's basically a sir, and he's what would end up fusing with Yahweh through the pluralization of his name, the Elohim. And there are several female figures, which are basically his allies. And whereas for Baal, it's really his sister, Anat, who's the one that protects him and revives him when he's incapacitated. So it's, again, if you're looking in Middle Eastern or Semitic mythologies, you don't have that same divine Assyrian thing. It's really a European or Indian concept, but it was highly influenced by concepts of deity in the Levant, in the Middle East. So it's much more of a fuzzy picture. And again, they all conflate and then divide in so many countless different ways. So it's really like a huge jigsaw puzzle. Many of the pieces are missing, but enough are still present that if you with a lot of care, you can put together a general overall world picture. And that's what I think, that's what my book was an attempt to do.
Well, I'll tell you, Michael, more and more, every time I think I got a handle on things, somebody teaches me something new, and I realize I'm not even sure what questions to ask.
Isn't that wonderful? That's what it's all about.
Well, you know, it keeps life interesting, that's for sure. Well, listen, I know it's very late there, and I appreciate so much, you brought so much to the show this morning for you, tonight for me. Was there anything else you'd like to leave listeners with before we say goodnight to you?
I can't think of anything now. It's now 4:15 for me, so I think I'm just going to go to sleep. But Karen, I really enjoyed the conversation with you. It's been a real pleasure.
Well, thank you so very much, and I hope we can do this again maybe when you're here in the United States or somewhere, and the time difference won't be so horrible for you.
All right. Well, we'll communicate on that. That is a possibility.
All right. Well, thank you.
Thank you
very much, Michael. And, go to sleep and sleep well, and have a wonderful spring.
And enjoy and have a fine rest of the show.
Thank you very much. Good night.
Bye. Good night now.
Well, listeners, if you're just tuning in, this is Karen Tate, hostess of Voices of the Sacred Feminine, where we discuss Goddess, the Divine Feminine, the resurging interest in right brain thinking and the feminine consciousness, whether the great She be deity, archetype, or ideal, and how these new values and benchmarks just might save the world. And our guest tonight was Michael York, proving men love the goddess too. Wasn't he great? And seriously, I have to go find that book of his, The Divine versus the Asurian, and learn more about these divine and anti-divine goddesses. Well, I am going to take a very brief, probably a 45-second break here to set up for the bottom of the hour. So I hope, listeners, you will stay with me. I'm going to let you listen to Maria by Be Optimistic. That's nice and upbeat. Stay with me, and I'll be back in 45 seconds. Thank you for staying with me, and I have a little surprise for you. Just listen to this for a minute. What does that sound like? The swarming bees? Well, yes, that's the cue that it's the What's the Buzz segment that's coming up now. So let me go ahead and start with that cartoon from God that I wanted to share with you. Well, I got this from one of the blogs that I look at pretty regularly called Salon.com, and I believe the author of this cartoon is Max Inc., and his column is Max Inc.'s Links, and the title is God Weighs In on the Healthcare Debate, and you see this picture of God in the clouds looking at a newspaper, and his thought bubble says, you'd think, given how much they care about the health and well-being of their unborn constituents, that they might give a shit about the health and well-being of those already born. Boy, did that strike a chord with me. I can't say it any better than that little cartoon right there. Yeah, you can go to salon.com if you want to print it out and post it like I did. The second thing I wanted to share with you tonight, in keeping with Women's History Month, I want you to know about the powerful visionary and chief of the Cherokee Nation. Her name is Wilma Mankiller, and like I said earlier, it's not because she doesn't like men. Actually, that last name, Mankiller, is a family surname, and it has something to do with traditional Cherokee military rank. But anyway, let me tell you a little bit about Wilma. She's the first woman chief of the Cherokee Nation. When Native women didn't assume leadership positions. Her activism began 40 years ago in November when Native students occupied the island of Alcatraz near San Francisco. Mankiller was honored as an extraordinary older woman at the AARP Conference on Diversity and Aging in Chicago recently, and she was interviewed by New America Media by the editor Khalili Abdullah. And I wanted to tell you a little bit about her because, she was a powerful woman. She was inducted in the National Women's Hall of Fame in 1993. She was a visionary and the first woman principal chief of the Cherokee Nation, like I said, and she was responsible for 139,000 people and a $69 million budget. She garnered numerous awards, Oklahoma Women's Hall of Fame, Woman of the Year, the John W. Gardner Leadership Award, the National Women's Hall of Fame. Her first book, Man Killer, A Chief and Her People, was an autobiography. It became a national bestseller. Gloria Steinem was a friend of hers and said in a review about that book, as one woman's journey, Man Killer opens the heart. As the history of a people, it informs the mind. Together, it teaches us that as long as people like Wilma Man Killer carry the flame within them, centuries of ignorance and genocide can't extinguish the human spirit. Her second book she co-authored is called Every Day is a Good Day, Reflections of a Contemporary Indigenous Woman. On the fun side, in 1994, she and singer Patsy Cline were among the inductees into the National Cowgirl Museum and Hall of Fame in Fort Worth, Texas. And one of Man Killer's sayings was, we've had daunting problems in many critical areas, speaking about her indigenous people, but I believe in the old Cherokee injunction, to be of good mind, and today that's called positive thinking. This is an extraordinary woman. She said that the watershed event in her life was when the Native American students occupied Alcatraz in 69. She looks back 40 years later on how events and mentors, including such luminaries as Roots author Alex Haley and United Farm Worker co-founder Dolores Huerta, actually shaped her activism. And one of the things that she says is, she talked about, you know, people who recognized a spark in her and, and gave her a chance. She said at an early age, she benefited from the guidance of a mentor to give context and meaning to everything that was going on around her. She said her life would have turned out very differently if a woman at the San Francisco Indian Center had not looked beyond her rough exterior and seen potential within her. She described the staff member at the center, Justine Buckskin, who extended a hand to her at a time when she needed it. And she says, when I think about women's rights organizations, I think about women extending a hand to other women. So the reason, besides the good works of all her life, I mention her is she needs everyone's prayers right now. So please keep Wilma Man Killer on your prayer altar. She's very ill. She's in a hospice suffering from cancer. And she's contributed so much to her people. And she's such a wonderful role model for women and for activists. So you can Google her if you want more information or to see what she looks like. That's Wilma Man Killer, the first woman Cherokee chief. Well, going on to the next part of What's the Buzz, 15 years ago, Hillary declared women's rights to be human rights, so we'll briefly discuss how far we've come since then. So here are some figures. Under the category of poverty, 25% of the world population was living in extreme poverty in 2005, compared to 50% in 1990. But this progress has been stalled and maybe even reversed by the current global economic crisis, which is expected to keep 73 to 100 million more people in poverty and disproportionately push women into economically vulnerable work. In education, there hasn't been much progress in these last 15 years. 54% of girls are out of school compared to 57% in 2002 and 64% in 1990. And women make up two-thirds of the world's illiterate. In health, the maternal mortality rate remains virtually unchanged. There are 450 maternal deaths per 100,000 live births in the developing world as of 2005, compared to 480 deaths in 1990. Violence against women has increased in many countries since 2005, with indigenous women, young women, and ethnic minorities particularly affected. Politics-wise, 8 countries had women heads of state in 2009. They were Argentina, Chile, Finland, India, Ireland, Lithuania and the Philippines and Liberia. Nearly 19% of parliamentary seats were held by women in 2009, which nearly doubled the 11.3% of 95, but it still falls short of the 2015 goal of 30% women in, holding political office. So disappointingly, but perhaps not surprisingly, we still have a lot of work to do. While the education attainment gap is closing in some parts of the world, because many countries have passed important legislation regarding gender discrimination and violence against women, the global economic crisis, as we said, has exacerbated women's poverty in the developing world. It's also adversely affected women's already low economic participation and threatens educational opportunity for girls and boys. Moreover, the progress that has occurred has been at a much slower pace than expected. In other words, there's plenty of work left to do. So we just have to keep an eye on stuff like that. We have to be aware of what's going on with women at home and around the globe. Let's see. Women in Haiti. This comes from the Ms. Magazine blog. Before the earthquake, Haiti's women's movement was vibrant and its momentum great, but feminist leaders have been lost. Buildings have been decimated, and everyone's trying to find ways to recapture what existed before. There was a system and structures for preventing, responding to, and tracking gender-based violence in Haiti before the earthquake. There was also a national plan to address violence against women. But how you track all of that when the structure, housing, the women's ministry has been absolutely crushed with many of the staff and nearly all the information lost. So they are starting from scratch. They're trying to sift through and see what still exists and build on that in order to provide services for women who need it. They're handing out referral cards that list hospitals where women survivors of violence can get support. And the camps where those who are homeless now live, conditions are difficult because women have no privacy, lighting is poor, sanitation facilities are few. But the situation changes every day, and they're looking for creative ways to meet women's needs, including community patrolling and improved lighting. They're providing tents for women's groups to use as safe spaces. They're reaching out to civil society groups to find ways to support women directly, including encouraging group members to take care of themselves. And they haven't stopped working, since the earthquake. So, obviously women's issues have not been swept under the rug. They're part of the rebuilding that needs to take place in Haiti, and people are paying attention. Now, something interesting also from Ms. Magazine called The Mystery of Women's History. You know, we often say women's history and culture has been forgotten, obscured, or even written out. Well, this article on the Ms. Magazine blog actually sort of corroborated that premise. The author is talking about how people may adore romance in their comedies and chocolate in their peanut butter, but mystery in our history can be hard to love, and she's so right. She said there's a problem when it comes to National Women's History Month. History, she says, we learn in schools about facts, which are names and places, dates and statistics, lists of battles, treaties, inventions, landmarks. Like science, history depends on the existence of actual material proof, documentary evidence that someone says something actually took place and happened. It's about the known, not the unknown. But there's a lot we don't know about women's history. Historians have long recognized that our view of history is tremendously skewed toward the people with the education and the leisure time to devote to documenting events and the resources to preserve their documents in books and libraries. In other words, elite males. We know most of what we know about women in the past because from time to time, individual women did things unusual enough that men took note of them. Think Cleopatra. Well, when it comes to history of women as a group with their own distinctive concerns, cultural dynamics, economic activities, and personal interactions, we know logically that there must be a history of that. There can't not be. When we look at the literature, though, there are enormous gaps. Sometimes we don't even know what kind of information we're missing until we want something and it's not there. The person who wrote the blog said she, for instance, realized this when she found out there was very little in history written on women's virginity or the history of heterosexuality. So anyway, these mysteries have something important to tell us. This year, Women's History Month, you know, she says that she's going to be blogging about some of the particularly political mysteries of women's lives. Why does so much female labor vanish when history books get written? Why don't we know more, historically speaking, about women's participation in misogyny? So to what extent can we, as the National Women's History Project urges, write women back into history without perpetuating factual and perceptual errors? After all, women are half of humanity, and women's history is half of history. So we owe it to ourselves as women to take a harder look at what that means. Well, I know a lot of women are doing just that. So let's be aware of women's history has been swept under the rug, and we need to dig it out. All right. I wanted to also share an article about sexual assault on female soldiers by Nancy Gibb from Time Online called Don't Ask, Don't Tell. I'm just going to briefly pull out a few snippets from this because we've talked about this before, but it bears repeating. Nancy Gibb says, what does it tell us that female soldiers deployed overseas stop drinking water at 7 p.m. to reduce the odds of being raped if they have to use the bathroom at night, or that a soldier who was assaulted when she went out for a cigarette was afraid to report it for fear she would be demoted for having gone out without her weapon, or that, as Representative Jane Harman of California put it, a female soldier in Iraq is more likely to be raped by a fellow soldier than killed by enemy fire. Well, the problem is pretty bad. The Pentagon estimates that 80 to 90% of sexual assaults go unreported, and it's no wonder. Anonymity is all but impossible because a government, the GAO, Government Accountability Office, report concluded that most victims stay silent because the belief that nothing's going to be done, the fear of ostracism, harassment, or ridicule, and concern that peers will gossip. More than half feared they would be labeled troublemakers. A civilian who's raped can get confidential or privileged advice from her doctors, lawyers, victims advocate, but the only privilege in the military applies to chaplains. A civilian who knows her assailant has a much better chance of avoiding him than does a soldier at a remote base where filing charges can be a career killer, not for the assailant, but for the victim. Okay, got that? The victim. Only 8% of cases that are investigated end in prosecution, compared to 40% for civilians arrested for sex crimes. And astonishingly, about 80% of those convicted, okay, in the military of raping a woman are honorably discharged. How about that? Experts offer many theories for the cause, that one being the military culture is intrinsically violent and hypermasculine, that the military is slow to identify potential risks among raw young recruits, that too many commanders would rather look the other way than acknowledge a breakdown in their units, and it hasn't been made a priority. But there are some signs that Congress and the Pentagon are getting serious about the problem. It's now possible for victims to seek medical treatment without having to report the crime to police or their chain of command. And more hospitals out in the field have trained nurse practitioners to treat the victims, and bases now have rape kits. So in closing about this little subject, big subject, sorry, according to a report by the Defense Task Force on Sexual Assault in the Military Service, the progress made so far remains evident but uneven. The failure to provide a basic guarantee of safety to women who now represent 15% of the armed forces is not just a moral issue or a morale issue. What does it say if the military can't or won't protect the people we ask to protect us? So that was by Nancy Gibbs, Times Online, Sexual Assaults on Female Soldiers, Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And let's see, to close out What's the Buzz, our final topic, I'm going to mention some ideas or concepts here, and I'm wondering if listeners will connect the dots and know who I'm talking about. If I say this this group of words or deeds or happenings, who do you think we're referring to? The Crusades, the Inquisition, oppression of women. How many people have died due to their no condom policy? That might be a dead giveaway. Genocide of other cultures. Pedophilia, that could be another dead giveaway. Helping the Nazis escape to South America. Well, there's another thing to add to this list, and I didn't have homophobia on there, but it should be on the list. The article that came out by one of my favorite writers for The Examiner, he's the Portland, Oregon humanist, Micah Stone. He brought to my attention that, because you won't see it in the evening news, that there's a male prostitution scandal now apparently rocking the Vatican. Let's see. I want to share some of this with you. It says a police investigation into corruption at the Vatican has taken a twist with the discovery of an organized network of male prostitution. So far, a senior aide to the Pope and a Vatican chorister have been removed from their post over allegations of involvement in the homosexual prostitution ring. The allegations were made public when Italian newspapers published transcripts of phone calls recorded by police. Police had been conducting an unrelated corruption investigation when they found these calls. Apparently, the tapes record Angelo Balducci. He is a gentleman of His Holiness. That's his title, a gentleman of His Holiness, negotiating with Thomas Chineda Eheim, a 29-year-old Nigerian Vatican chorister, about men he wanted brought to him for sexual purposes. Balducci held a high position within the Vatican and carried the coffin of Pope John Paul at his 2005 funeral. He has now lost his position as a gentleman of His Holiness. And the tape conversations include Balducci describing precise physical details of the men he desired. Balducci was a member of one of the world's most exclusive fraternities, again, the Gentlemen of His Holiness, or Papal Gentlemen, who are actually the ceremonial ushers of the papal household. The scandal is just the newest scandal in a seemingly never-ending series of scandals involving the Catholic Church. There's no telling how extensive the prostitution ring is within the Vatican or what, if any, knowledge Pope Benedict had of the nefarious activities taking place within his household. So, Micah goes on to say, the scandal is yet another indication of the corruption and moral hypocrisy which surrounds the Pope and permeates the Catholic Church. Interesting, interesting. Well, to close out another What's the Buzz segment for tonight, I'd like to leave you with another special little sound effect I got for the show. I promise I'll get better at using these. Tonight was a practice run. Well, that concludes our What's the Buzz segment for tonight. As long as you keep telling me you like this segment and as long as there are important things to talk about, I'll be a voice for the ideals of the Great She. We have to really try to do our best to teach and to share ideas that offset the negative and toxic attitudes that breed so much intolerance and hate and war and disharmony and injustice and imbalance. And as I'm fond of saying, we have to keep working to reach that 100th monkey, to shift that paradigm, to put that morphic field in motion so change comes, and it will. So let's use the steam of Bridget, the tenacity of Sekhmet, the social justice of Kali to set this in motion. So with that being said, the bees are released from my bonnet for yet another week. Okay, so let me just get to announcements now. For those of you in Southern California, I want to remind you that if you have attended our Isis and Mary Magdalene birthday salons and teas in the past, which are usually held in Long Beach, here's a shout-out to you to save the date of July 11th. We are going to have it at the Vintage Tea Leaf Tea House in Long Beach, which is our regular spot that most attendees are accustomed to coming to. So that is July 11th in the afternoon. I'll be telling you more as the event approaches, but please save the date if you are interested. Also, coming up on Saturday, April 3rd, is the Queen of Your Realm Convocation, number 3 in the series, with Ava, who is the founder and center holder at the Goddess Temple of Orange County. And Convocation 3, the topic is the Queen's Relations, which covers love, family, men, and her sacred or magical animals. And just a brief snippet about the Queen's Convocation, about this Queen of Your Realm series and the Queen's teachings from Ava. Ava says, in ancient times, great queens of many lands came together to learn from one another, to laugh and cry together, to share their hard-won knowledge in a spirit of equality for everyone's benefit. At the conclusion of the convocation, the queens were refreshed in spirit, heart, mind, and body, and returned to their own lands empowered and energized. We too convene as queens for the same purpose in our own time, for our own realms. Although we women live in a patriarchy that tells us otherwise, still, the queen lives in us, for the queen aspect in woman is an immortal who can never be killed. She may be imprisoned for a time, but she always finds a way out because resourceful and focused and using divine help, she perseveres. The queen teachings are a path to freedom and power for women. And here's one of Ava's quotes I really like. When the goddess got thrown out of religion, the queen got thrown out of women. So if you, this sort of piques your curiosity, if you'd like to attend at the Goddess Temple in Irvine, California, this is happening on April 3rd. You can go to the website and register. That's goddesstempleoforangecounty.com. Or here's the phone number, 949-651-0564. I'll give that to you one more time, 949-651-0564. The cost to attend is $65. It includes a champagne dinner fit for a queen, printed notes in a folder, memorable ritual, keepsake gold writing pen, and wonderful energy with wonderful women. I can attest to that. I've attended the last two and highly recommend the event. And that was April 3rd. Now, I just found out a couple days ago that there is going to be an event in Hollywood. And if you're, again, in Southern California, Hollywood Now in the city of West Hollywood presents Remembering Herstory. The personal is political. The political is personal. Absolutely. And the guest speaker is a friend of mine, Lydia Rule. She is the author of Goddess Icon Spirit Banners of the Divine Feminine. Lydia will trace the transformation of goddesses from leading participants in origin stories to fierce divinities bearing goddess daughters to being born of men and giving birth to male gods. On display will be samples of her banners. This is at 2 o'clock, Saturday, March 27th. And the address is 1000 North Kings Road, West Hollywood, California. For more information, go to this email address, hollywoodnow@hotmail.com, hollywoodnow@hotmail.com. A suggested donation, because this is a fundraiser, is $10 at the door. Also coming up this Saturday, again, down in Southern California, we have a lot going on, is the next class in the series, Cakes for the Queen of Heaven, which go on through July at the Goddess Temple in Irvine, which is in Orange County. Have you wanted to be able to understand and explain your interest in goddess spirituality and talk about it confidently? Do you want to take a shortcut to reading all those books to get yourself up to speed? Then consider giving yourself the gift of these sacred teachings. It's the class you've been waiting for. And the Unitarian Universalists who put this curriculum together said that the most common feedback they've gotten from participants over the years is it changed my life. So Cakes for the Queen of Heaven, this two-part series religious educational seminar in feminist theology for women and teenage girls created by the Unitarian Universalist Women. runs every 2 weeks through July, and we resume this Saturday with the class called Reclaiming Women's Heritage of Power on March 13th. We'll examine the history of the peace of ancient matristic civilizations and ending the violence in our personal and global lives. This is the last class of Series 1. We're going to take a break in April so that students might reclaim, rethink, and restore all they've learned of their sacred history in the last five classes. And then May 8th, Series 2 starts, and we will discover the female imagery and the presence that was ignored in Judaism and Christianity. We'll be looking at the painful suppression of female experience in Western religious tradition and relating our personal discoveries and experience to our individual identities and exploring new world views and theologies for the future. Classes are $25 a class. You do not have to take the entire series, but it is recommended if you can. All proceeds from the class benefit the Goddess Temple of Orange County. So if you would like more information about that, I am actually the teacher of this series and having a wonderful time. You can email me at karentate108@ca.rr.com. Now, let's see what's left here for announcements. I want to remind folks that I am planning to lead a goddess tour to Turkey, and that will happen probably September of 2011. So start saving your pennies as I will be doing. I'll give you more information as it is available. And in May, I'm going to be traveling to San Francisco because the Feminist Methodist group up there called Her Church has invited me to come discuss the art of pilgrimage and the mysticism of sacred sites of goddess. So if you're up in the Bay Area, let me, you know, give me a shout out. Let me know you're there. I'd love to meet you. And if you're interested in the tour to Turkey, keep in touch with me. Let's see. Next week and in the coming weeks, let me just tell you who is going to be on the show. On next Wednesday, the 17th of March, we're going to have author Leslene De La Madre. She's going to discuss raising daughters and patriarchy, how to keep the lineage from mother to daughter intact, and how to still raise bright new voices for goddess. So she is the next week, followed the following week by Joan Norton, author of Mary Magdalene Within and co-author with Margaret Starbird of her second book, 14 Steps to Awaken the Sacred Feminine. And also joining Joan will be Katarina Fretwell with some of her sweeping and intense poetry dedicated to the Sacred Bride, which is another name for Mary Magdalene. And don't miss Joan's website and blog at marymagdalenewithin.org. And to finish out March, on the 31st, we're going to have Julie Raymond, author of We the Trees, on the show. She's written a book of goddess fiction about ancient priestesses in Cappadocia, Turkey, which is what we call Cappadocia today. It's actually the region of Turkey. And her book discusses how our ancestral memory helps us in creative ways as we rethink, reclaim, and remember past lives, courageous women in ancient times. And at the bottom of the hour, instead of What's the Buzz, we've invited one of your favorites back, David Hillman, PhD and author, and we're going to discuss the new movie, Clash of the Titans, and compare mythology we think we know, that we've learned and been taught through a Christian or Western lens, versus what the original text actually say and mean. Don't miss that. And actually, David has written an article in my Examiner column that you won't want to miss. It's titled Thank Christianity for Feminism. Now, I'm sure that piques your curiosity. So go to examiner.com, and you can put my name in the search box. Articles by me or about me will pop up, or go to my website, karentate.com, and at the very top of the home page, you'll see a link to my column, and you can click on the column there and read that article by David and other interesting things, too, that are sitting there in the archives. And if you do go to the website, I invite you to visit the media page and catch some of the radio interviews that I'm invited to do, or go to my YouTube channel where I have some videos of the Isis Temple of Thanksgiving, Sekhmet's Mountain Sanctuary, and snippets of a lecture that I gave on the Sacred Feminine for a Sustainable Future. And since it is spring, there are downloadable meditations there, free for your enjoyment. There is one specifically for spring, and there's another one that's spring-oriented that is a journey down the Nile to an Isis temple, which you know, people have really given me good feedback about. So please, you know, they're right there, downloadable and free. Take advantage of them. Go there when you can and enjoy. Let's see. I think that probably wraps it up for tonight. And what I'd like to do is sort of transition into tonight's evening prayer. And I invite you to close your eyes and take a deep breath with me and bring an even deeper focus to these lovely words of the Dalai Lama. Okay, the Dalai Lama says, I try to stay joyful. If we want to work effectively for freedom and justice, it's better to do so without anger or deviousness. If we ourselves feel calm and if we act with a sincere motivation, we can accomplish many things in the 30 or 50 active years of our life. And if some positive results have already been seen from this approach, I think I can say that this is in part because of my commitment to the pacifist cause, a commitment which is motivated by a genuine belief in the brotherhood of mankind. We are not a very large or powerful nation, but our way of life, our culture, and our spiritual traditions have helped us follow the way of peace, even at times of tremendous difficulty and hardship, and have given us courage and our wish to develop love and compassion. When the time comes, the Tibetan people longs with all its heart to take responsibility for the high plateau, which is our homeland, and to transform it into a sanctuary of peace where mankind will live side by side with nature in harmony. And those are the words of the Dalai Lama. And with those words, I would like to close tonight's show. And thank you for tuning in. And I hope you'll be back with us next Wednesday night at 6 p.m. Pacific. And that's all until then. Good night. And may the great She embrace you in her golden wings.
We honor now the Celtic Bard. We offer up our praise. Guardians of our mysteries. Keepers of the old days. Seasons, the sun, through birth, and all nature's lessons for